This is Jennifer Stone with Stone's Throw. Jingle bells. Oh, the season, my season, the dark time, the winter. I hear the ghosts of Christmas past. This morning, all I could think of was Mitch McConnell as Ebenezer Scrooge, but I don't think the Charlie Dickens is going to help us this time. Maybe Victor Hugo in Les Miserables. You know, I hope the ex-president refers to refugees and immigrants as human scum, the language of thuggery, as several senators and pundits have called it. Yes, I have all these notes here about suburban classrooms back in the day, about how difficult it was to teach black culture to white kids, about how hard it was to even teach white kids about, say, using Nina Simone's The Strange Fruit or The Liberating Power of Mississippi Goddamn. And then finally, I just got it down to the modern poets. Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan were my favorites. You will notice recently, that is year before last, was it, that Bob Dylan got the Nobel Prize for Literature. It surprised him as much as it did a lot of other people, but I think he just about hit the nail on the head. I remember after a teacher complained when she heard the song, being played, I had to go home and just get the lyrics, get them down on paper, print, because I wasn't allowed to play the music. And of course, as you know, without the music, poetry is very often lost. That is a big message. I think who said something about that? I have it right here. Somebody said something about that. Anyway, I can't find it. It was about the need for the sound. Right here it is, yes. The element of song is an essential, yes. That lyric impulse, it says, transmuted itself through music into late 20th century poetry. Aha. Bob Dylan, yes. The poetry of the masses is certainly pop music lyrics. Leonard Cohen, the first to come through, at least for me it was, in any case. Let me give you two lines before I get back to the students. I think you will remember, or if you don't, this is Bob Dylan's poem, Love Minus Zero, No Limit. The bridge at midnight trembles, the country doctor rambles, the banker's nieces seek perfection, expecting all the gifts that wise men bring. The wind howls like a hammer, the night bells raining. My love, she's like some raven at my window, with a broken wing. My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals of iron. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true, like ice, like fire. People carry roses and make promises by the hours. My love, she laughs like the flowers. Valentines can't buy her. In the dime stores and bus stations, people talk of situations, read books, repeat quotations, draw conclusions on the wall. Some speak of the future, my love, she speaks softly. She knows there's no success like failure. and that failure is no success at all. Ah, the cloak and dagger dangles, madams light the candles. And on this incredible poem goes. I have loved it for half a century, yes. The wind howls like a hammer. Actually, Bob Dylan is damn near as old as I am. Not quite, actually, no. I was listening to a younger singer do a tribute to Nina Simone last night, and I got quite nostalgic. I can't help it. I just go back to the ghosts of Christmas past. I have some notes here about, there's an article from last June in the New Yorker called The Trayvon Generation, and it's very moving. Yes, June 22, I think, of this past year, the Trayvon Martin Generation. The Trayvon Generation is very tragic, but it's funny because to me, it's not an echo, it's not a shadow, it's the same thing. Now, this is an article I wrote, 1997 for the Mama Bears News and Notes called Black is Beautiful. It begins with Toni Morrison's quote. God bless Toni Morrison, yes. She writes, race has become metaphorical. It is a way of referring to and disguising forces, events, classes, and expressions of social decay and economic division far more threatening to the body politic than biological race, in quotes, ever was. And that's Toni Morrison in an essay she wrote in 1992, the year before she won her Nobel Prize for Literature. The essay was called Playing in the Dark from Harvard University Press. Indeed. Strange how many of these great artists are part of what I call now the Creole Nation, our Creole Nation. I guess we still have people who call themselves white folks. I don't do that, but basically, what I'm hearing today and what I heard from Toni Morrison in her last book and in the last couple of years is the distinctions that must be made between race and color. For some reason or another, this is just hard for people. Back in 1902, W.E.B. Du Bois, great scholar, he wrote, the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line. It's not about race, it's about color. The magnificent song, Nina Simone's song, Four Women, you know. The first woman says, I am black. She goes on to tell her story. The next woman says, I am yellow, and tells her story. And then the third, I am tan. And I think the last one is called Sweet Thing. Anyway, it's a masterpiece. And I think that, it all recalls Entesaki Shange's play for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. That's seven women all up on stage telling their separate stories. And it clearly distinguishes race and color because, as Toni Morrison tells us, biological race doesn't exist. There is no such thing. We know that now. But this goes back when you're 10, 20, 28 years ago. That's what it is, boys and girls. Now, the article about the Trayvon generation also quotes Toni Morrison. It's a personal history by Elizabeth Alexander. She's writing about her two sons. They're in their 20s now, but she is telling them, what it means to be a parent. Let me read to you. She quotes Toni Morrison's novel, Sula. Now, the novel is set across the bleak black stretch of Ohio after the First World War. The character Hannah plaintively asks her mother, Eva Peace, "Mama, did you ever love us?" To paraphrase Eva Peace's reply, "Love you? Love you? I kept you alive." Soon, when I have time, I want to read you more of this marvelous personal history by Elizabeth Alexander, because she thinks that her generation is a failure. It's just that we need better understanding. You see, she tries to hide media from her children and, you know, take away the bad stuff the way my parents took away the World War II bad stuff. But she says, I was too late. Too late generationally, because they, that is her sons, the young people of today, they were not looking at the newspaper. They were looking at their phones, where the image was a house of mirrors straight to hell. Yes, she goes on to say, my love was both rational and fantastical. Can I protect my sons from being demonized? And it goes on, and it is, of course, heartbreaking. I will save it for another time, because I want to jump back into my own past, the ghosts of Christmas past, right? Once upon a time, in Oakland, before Black English came to be called Ebonics, that's an amalgam of ebony and phonics, I had a job teaching English in the public schools. Footnote here, some people will not even remember Ebonics. It is a little difficult for some people to understand. Yes, kind of like Cockney, you know. Anyway, Dick Gregory, I remember, came to visit. He told the students that they were in school to learn how to live, not how to make a living. Oh, that was the late 60s, when Black Power inspired students to embrace their history, their culture. I think of Henry Louis Gates. Lately, I watched him on television. He does a wonderful job of history and culture, starting with Africa. Anyway, Henry Louis Gates, he sits down with individuals, prominent individuals, and traces their ancestry back. And it's quite startling for a lot of people. They really didn't know who was in their family tree. Anyway, back in the day, yes, the kids were putting up posters and poetry and newspapers. They didn't have any phones yet, no cell phones. But they found everything which expressed the theme, Black is beautiful. I think that we can easily compare it to Black Lives Matter. I kind of like Black is Beautiful, but anyway, the Black Panther Party's school breakfast program back then, it did a hell of a lot more for education than I could do. The food was prepared mostly by the moms, and they saw to it that kids had enough calories to stay awake in class. Little dental work, yes. I saw deeply depressed children beginning to feel good about themselves. I got carried away. Black liberation, that seemed to me a goal worth fighting for. One day the principal came into my classroom and he saw the handwriting on the wall. Kid wrote, Afro Agony, tell it like it was. And then under that, Damn the pigs. Damn spelled D-A-M. Up there on the board were all the works by black writers. There was a quote from the French writer George Sand, dated 1848. There is only one race, and classes spring from brigandage. Yes, thieves, robbers, slave traders. I knew my days were numbered. Today, this issue of Ebonics, well, it entered the national conversation briefly, and then I think it's pretty much gone away. A quarter of a century before that, back in the middle of the 20th century, it was verboten even to raise the subject. Now, today, well, that is 1997, when I was writing this essay, senators are holding hearings to examine educators and administrators, right? None of these guys have any real knowledge of linguistics. Even black scholars refer to themselves, yes, well, they think of themselves as using a good English. They refer to bad or broken English when they talk about Ebonics. Nobody, absolutely nobody speaks about the meaning behind the words. Prudery, that's my word. Prudery, word prudes, a universal mob habit. You know, your mother will always say, don't say that, yes. People talk about high standards. They should just simply say, my standards, and be done with it. As a feminist, my standards are constantly violated by phallocentric language. I suffer acutely from pronoun envy. We all know that linguistic patriarchs guard the gate. In fact, they own the gate. The gatekeepers go ballistic when we refuse to speak their language in their accents. He who owns the gate determines our fate. When the powerless talk back, the cognitive elite meet to defeat our attempt to redefine their empire in decline. Remember the words of Humpty Dumpty in Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass? In rather a scornful tone, Humpty Dumpty says, quote, when I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. Alice says, the question is whether you can make words mean so many different things. Humpty Dumpty answers, the question is, which is to be master? That's all. In school, I had a teacher who used to talk about the master narrative. And I don't know, maybe she thought it was Shakespeare. But anyway, I think she meant the accepted narrative, you know. For example, a hero could not be a woman, that kind of thing. Anyway, master and slave is all about dominance and submission. There's a little of that dominant submission thing going on with men and women, actually. Today, we, most of us, are slaves to the corporations. That means we must speak business English. When I taught African-American students, I wanted to give them freedom to choose. What cannot be said, cannot be thought or taught. It's about being inclusive. Multiculturalism means you gotta read more than one book. Socioeconomic mobility demands you speak more than one language. Now, this schism is about otherism. As I said to Jefferson Brown, age 15, one day I said, "Why don't you want to talk like me?" We both broke down laughing. Now, what I learned during those years in Oakland, I learned the pathology of identity politics. Self-esteem is all about loving your true self. In order to find your power, you must be authentic. You must have the authority of your own voice. You must be the author of your own existence. You got that? Author, authentic, authority. Around the globe, we see indigenous peoples clinging to their home languages. I even listen to Gaelic when I'm blue or when I've had a drink. Of course, I'm cut off from any root language I may have had. I try to assimilate wherever I am, find myself living here. I try to belong in this strange land. As a very young woman studying theater, BBC English was my goal. By the time that went out of fashion, I was neither English, Irish, nor American. Just affected, yes. There's something now called the Mid-Atlantic accent, meaning, I guess, halfway between New York and London. Who knows? I think we still hear BBC English on the radio. Anyway, we know that the voice is an expression of the soul. Maybe it is the soul. I am only just a lost soul, cut off from the runes of my roots. That's R-U-N-E-S, the room. Now, I have seen soul murder done to children. Children despised for their speech and for their writing, which is only a technology for recording speech. Black English is too colorful for the gray world of middle-class values. White or black, the middle class is repressive in every society. They have the most to lose, yes. As the black feminist writer Bell Hooks tells us, we are all addicted to white supremacy. Not our fault, you know. It's like patriarchy. White supremacy is a global addiction. Clarence Thomas and Judge Bork. You know, they speak the same language. You remember Clarence Thomas. He's been on the Supreme Court now for nearly 3 decades. Judge Bork, well, we managed to avoid his presence on the Supreme Court, but he had a great deal to do with the selection of Clarence Thomas. Long story, Anita Hill, you know. The language of the stuffed shirt is, of course, the language of the employed, first of all. In Russian, it's kind of an insult to be called businesslike, the word for that. But, well, I mean, it was back when the Russians were still Soviets. But poets and socialists know that language is always all about class warfare. And bourgeois class distinctions, they're all about money, all about hierarchy, about who is the boss of it. As I used to say to my children, yes, who's the boss of it? I've got the money. Actually, that wasn't altogether true, but I just think that, you know, the problem is always... What do we call this? Jockeying for position, competing. Who is better than whom? All about the pecking order. All about being a snob. Yes. In my struggle to liberate students, I tried out one play by George Bernard Shaw, Pygmalion. Now, that's a social satire. It was later adapted as the musical My Fair Lady, but it's all about a Cockney flower girl, Eliza Doolittle. She wanted to learn how to speak like a lady. As one of my students said, she didn't want to say axe. That was wrong, she said. Eliza, you see, wants to speak like a lady who will, have a flower shop. That is, she'll be an entrepreneur. Anyway, when Eliza discovers the hypocrisy of the class system, she rebels. In the play, Eliza is the bastard child of Alfred P. Doolittle, a dustman who proclaims himself one of the undeserving poor. Doolittle is his own man, one of the unrepentant rascals Shaw is so fond of. Doolittle resists middle-class morality with all his Celtic charm. He is secure in his birthright as an Englishman, even if he doesn't speak like Peter O'Toole. He does not need or even want to better himself. In a Eurocentric world, God is an Englishman, even if his Cockney brogue is too thick to understand. I remember asking students to compare Doolittle with a black character in one of our plays, one of Wilson's plays, perhaps, some character who is delighted to be a member of the undeserving poor. Anyway, in all cultures, poetry and song come into the language from the working class. The reactionaries are always prigs. It is the jazz in American language that comes to us from black culture. There's much more in this article about how it is that modern American English is jazz. Yes, a tragedy and at the same time an incredible historical fact. Beautiful thing. This has been Jennifer Stone with Stone's Throw.